Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Telerik. Create compelling app experiences across any screen with the Telerik platform. Telerik's end-to-end platform uniquely combines industry-leading UI tools with cloud services to simplify the entire app development cycle. Telerik offers everything .NET developers need to build quality apps faster. Try it free at telerik.com/platform. That's telerik.com/platform.
From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 491. In this episode, Scott talks with Kat Small from SoundCloud about being a designer and a front-end developer.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today we're talking with Kat Small. She's a product designer and a developer. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Fantastic. Thanks for coming on the show today. You actually do so many different things. You do product design, you do UX, you do front-end development, you speak at conferences, and you also do a lot of prototyping, and you think about how prototyping and UX design fits into the larger product lifecycle.
Yeah, I find it so interesting. So my background is, a bit of, design and programming. And I've always been curious throughout the years as I've become more on the design side in terms of user experience about, like, how can code kind of fit into these things? Where can we, how can designers think about, the experience in a way that involves code and how can programming really kind of enhance the prototyping phase of design?
Yeah, I've tried design prototyping where I literally just took a 3x5 series of cards and tried to make a fake, you know, a fake phone and like handed it to a user and like, pretend this is a phone. Swipe like you would swipe and then just throw the top card off, you know, but it doesn't quite work. And then you see those, there's like balsamic where you get to scribble and stuff.
Yeah.
What do you think about those interactive make a fake app design tools?
I think they're all incredibly useful. So I've also experimented with other kinds of prototyping tools. I've definitely done some paper prototyping kinds of things. I've messed with Envision. I've messed with Axure, a couple of others. But I've always just found it, I guess because I've been spoiled by code in a way, it just doesn't often come close enough to the actual experience of seeing what it's like in that context, being able to control things and really make them feel close to what they'd be like in the actual experience. I will say that, there are some really good ones that are getting very close, such as, Framer.js, which uses CoffeeScript or JavaScript. That's, of course, still code, but, it's not nearly as in-depth as certain, other things would be with coding. But that's been really interesting to see happen. I think the good thing is that there's so many tools and that, the nice thing about that is that everyone's got an option, but I still think that nothing comes close to the actual experience of, seeing what it's like on the phone or on the computer and really feeling that seamless experience that you get with code.
Why do you think that there are so many products and companies and things that are trying to keep designers and UX people from just coding? Like the one that you liked the most, you just said, well, it uses CoffeeScript, right? Which for you as a developer isn't a big deal, but for someone else, that might be a huge barrier. But why don't we just make them learn how to code?
Totally. unfortunately, not everyone is really amenable to the idea of programming, or they might have tried it and they just hated it, which is totally a valid, completely valid experience. And I think there is space for everyone. It's just, it's kind of unfortunate because there's something better when you can actually program, but it's also not just that. It's also that you have that literacy in a way, and you can actually communicate better with people. I think some people are just not used to it, and so they're kind of a little afraid. Some people might be scared for their jobs because, like, if we have designers who can code, what's the point of a front-end developer? Other people just feel kind of threatened or like they have to compete. So I definitely understand why some people might not want to have designers who code, but I think it does have its benefits for sure. And I definitely encourage anyone who is interested in designing, like, they should definitely learn about programming for whatever device they're going to be designing for. And I also encourage developers to learn about design, because like when we have more people kind of blending, I think there's a really interesting thing that happens there.
Yeah, you bring up a really interesting point, though, that it's going to end up on the phone eventually. Like, let us as designers not forget that. Like, it's really great to do crazy stuff in Illustrator or Photoshop, then only to be told later by the developer that that's not possible. If you're a developer, though, you would know that.
Totally, yeah. And so one of the things I also really encourage people to do if they're not going to learn to code is to at least try to communicate as often as possible. But I definitely think that when designers learn how to code, they learn the limitations of whatever they're working with, and they learn the capabilities of what they're working with. They learn how exactly to communicate with people who are going to be building it out. And so there's just like wonderful benefits. There's so many of them. It's like hard to name all of them. But then you also start thinking in a different way. You think earlier about animations and interactivity and those kinds of things. And so instead of sticking to something that feels really static in a way, you end up with something that feels more fluid and natural, I think.
Mm-hmm. And if you're familiar with the way animations should look on Android versus iOS, and how the, for lack of a better word, the idiomatic UX style of that particular platform, as opposed to what we often see, which is like an app from, I don't know, unnamed company that looks like unnamed company's app on every platform, as opposed to looking like it's comfortable within material design or it's comfortable within iOS design.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, that's the other wonderful part. And I've actually started learning a bit of Android development for that reason, because I wanted to understand what are Android components? How does Android specifically work? And the other thing I try to do is actually use a product from each operating system. So I do have Windows on my Mac. I don't have a Windows phone yet, but I do want to get one, or a Windows tablet, to get that experience. I also have an iPad. I have an Android phone, and I just really try to make sure I am familiar with all of these things, because again, it goes back to being able to communicate properly about it and understanding what makes each operating system special. The same thing applies to coding. When you understand why programming is important and what it does and how you can use it, you have this understanding that other people just unfortunately don't have, and it becomes another strength in your toolkit.
Backing up a little bit, you touched on a really interesting point, which was potentially management could say, oh, well, the designer can code, therefore we don't need a front-end developer. As if, you know, first, as if people are interchangeable like that, right?
Yeah. It's so sad. So that's the thing, is I think there's space for everyone to kind of exist in an environment. I think that the good thing about being at SoundCloud is that there is space for someone like me who's more of a hybrid. And the thing that I've been able to do is code a prototype up to a certain point. And I'm still definitely working on figuring out what is the best time to start doing that kind of thing. But it's really been great to kind of, just be able to prototype something, test it on enough people, modify the prototype, and then do some screenshots or some kind of thing to communicate with the front-end engineers and the back-end engineers and say, this is what we're going to build. And then I just being able to give that to them for them to, in a lot of cases, just copy and paste code from has been really amazing and interesting to experiment with.
Well, that's interesting. So I was right with you. I was like nodding. And then you said copy and paste code from. And then that got me asking myself, well, wait a second. When you express this design in the code, are you saying it should look like this, developer? Or are you saying it should be this and developer?
Yeah.
And then, you know, are you expressing intent with code, or are you getting them started? Are you jumpstarting their project by giving them code that they can, like you said, copy paste from?
Ideally, somewhere in the middle. That's the hope, is that, and again, I'm still trying to, like, every time I work on a new project, I'm trying to figure out exactly where this happens and how it happens. And I've also worked with different people who kind of have different preferences. Some people I've prototyped things and they've just been like, well, why aren't you just building this like in the repository, just go do that. And that's been really interesting and really great. Because I love, you know, getting to just ship production stuff. Like, that's really cool. But some people are also a little bit more protective of their environment or like the repository that we're actually shipping stuff on. So in those cases, it's better to, in their case, like copy paste, or perhaps they just are coding in a different way and they kind of have like certain preferences around how they're building things. And so it really kind of depends. But I think in most cases, we're definitely starting to communicate more. This is the exact intent. This is how it just kind of take it from here. And the rest, I mean, like, you don't have as much to do, but it's really about refining it and making sure that it's production ready instead.
You're describing, though, it seems like you're being very polite about it, though, that people's egos sometimes get in the way of UX versus dev. And some want a bright line and some are like, oh, great, you know, Kat wrote 40% of that. I'll just keep going in the direction she was going.
Totally. I think it is funny to watch those kinds of dynamics happen. I love working with people who are really flexible, but that isn't always the case, unfortunately. And a lot of people are still kind of afraid, or they're just, they think that development is done in one way, and that's not always the case. It's been interesting because I've been looking into different methodologies and different ways of thinking. Like, there's been a really interesting movement called Balance Team, and that's been really cool because it's people who are all hybrids and they're all really flexible.
Balanced team. Balanced team.
Yeah. They're really, really interesting. And they're all about the idea of hybrid designers, developers, researchers, managers, like all of that kind of stuff. And I think it's really interesting because I think as time goes on, people are becoming definitely more flexible. But I also totally understand the fear that some people have, because, again, some people might be afraid that they could lose their job, because who needs a front-end developer when there's a UX designer or a product designer who can code? But I think, again, there's space for all of these people because the more hands you have on deck, the more you can do. And it's just so helpful to have someone whose main focus is really about refining and producing this code rather than kind of like prototyping this thing, getting it to the best in terms of the experience that the person's going to see, and then kind of like going off to the next thing, really. And I also think that I tend to be a bit, I get to finish something and then I want to go to the next thing. I don't want to really spend that much time refining it until I've had space from it. And then I want to come back later and see what can we do next to really make this even better.
Mm-hmm. One thing that you've said now twice separately in two different parts of our conversation today is the concept of being afraid that you might lose your job. And I'm glad that you say that. I love that you said that, because I have felt that way also. And I've felt like I oscillate back and forth between, well, should I be a deep expert on this thing, or should I be a Swiss Army knife and be kind of good at a bunch of little things? And I keep hearing people use this term full stack developer, except I feel that they're using it in the wrong way, because they're implying that they are literally awesome at everything as opposed to being generalists. And I'm curious what do you think about that?
Totally. So I often advise people to do the whole T-shaped thing where it's like they have like broad experience and then they're really deep in something. Like they have really deep experience in like one or a couple of things. I definitely would consider myself to be a generalist. I think it's really about personal preference, because some people are just naturally, they just don't like doing a bunch of different things. They want to focus on one thing and just go with that. And I think there should be space for those kinds of people, and they should feel comfortable, because, again, like a person who's a generalist often needs to feel like satisfied by doing a bunch of different things. So they'll be hopping back and forth between something. And while they're hopping back and forth between doing different things, you've got a person who's specializing, who's working on the things that the generalist kind of hopped between. And so I think there's like this natural kind of rhythm that can be created by having both kinds of people. And I think at SoundCloud, we've done a pretty good job of that by, you know, asking people, are you interested in like working across different platforms, or do you just kind of want to work on one thing? And I think we're pretty open to both of those kinds of people because they're, again, just so important to have. And I think it's also kind of like another kind of diversity, working style diversity.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think also it needs to be said at some level, either the team leader level or at the company culture level, that it's okay to have picked one style, because I'm afraid sometimes. I have been doing this for 20 years, and there have been times when let me give you an example. I'll work with someone who's a performance tuning person, and they'll take my code and they'll make it 10x faster, mm-hmm. right? And they're like, hey, look, we made it 10x faster. And they're totally cool about it. But then in my mind, I'm like, wow, my code sucked 10 times worse than it does now. I really should be better at that. But then I realized that, as you said, this is a great analogy. They're a T-shaped person where they go deep, deep, deep into perf. And then I feel guilty. I feel like an imposter that I did not know how to do that. But you have to accept that you can't know all of that stuff deeply, can you?
Yeah, I mean, I actually feel like that all the time. just because, you know, like when you're doing so much stuff, sometimes you don't have the time or the ability to really focus down on one thing as much as you might like to. But yeah, I mean, I think it comes down to, again, like just being in a workplace where people can comfort you and give you that comfort that, you know, just because you're like focusing on programming something and then researching something and then designing the experience and then doing all these other things, that you can still like there is still a place for you there. And the more that we have companies that do that and stop relying completely on one type of person or the other type of person, I think, that'll be really helpful, in the future in terms of like making sure that people don't feel like they need to compete with each other or that they need to do something, that just really doesn't jive well with the way they personally work.
Mm-hmm. And do you think it also has to do with the size of the project? Like you've worked on small projects on the side and open source and things. And, you know, you and three or four people and 20,000 lines of code is one thing. But then you on a team with 50 to 100 people and a million lines of code is a whole other universe, and how you interact and how you work on those things.
Yeah, that's been the most interesting part of being at SoundCloud, I think, is just figuring out like, how can I contribute to code and how can I still do design work and how can I be a generalist in here? Like we have our UX research team. We've got product designers. We have a marketing team. We have front-end developers and back-end developers. Everyone's been really supportive, but that's because the culture and the environment has been created and cultivated around that kind of supportive feeling. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely really interesting to see like when you get to, you know, 200 million users, how can you still have generalists working on things? Because again, it goes back to that performance factor. You need to have this code ready to work for millions of people. So I've definitely been looking into exactly how do people write code at SoundCloud, because there is a specific style. And I think that's one of the interesting things that you can do is when your company gets large enough, you need to have a style guide for these kinds of things. You need to make sure that your documentation is well written. All of these things really help to enable not only generalists, but people who want to eventually be specialists in whatever they're working on at your company. I think all of those things are really helpful for both kinds of people.
When you are dealing with a product that's going to touch that many people, like you said, you know, millions and millions, you know, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people, how do you ever have a sense of analysis paralysis where it's like, I want this animation to work like this? But then you find that, well, 25% of our users have crappy video cards or what, like, and you can imagine, right? The decision tree goes so far. Where do those things get figured out? Do you suss them out, or does an animation expert suss them out, or do you figure them out in production?
It's a complicated process for sure. I think what we usually end up doing is a lot of times we'll look at analytics. So we have a lot of insights and analytics at SoundCloud, and we really focus a lot on it because we want to understand what our capabilities are. So a lot of the times what will help me make decisions in terms of, can we do this thing? Can we animate this thing? Can we use this component? Can we use Flexbox, for example? It's really about how well supported is it and how many people are using something that supports it. So that's been a really interesting set of conversations that we've had. I do end up doing a lot of contributing to decision making regarding those things. It involves a lot of facilitating conversations between people. And I actually find that to be very interesting as well, because I don't know, there's something fun about kind of just talking to someone and being like, oh, you know, can we do this cool new thing? And, you know, they'll say like, oh, okay, how many people can actually see this cool new thing that we want to do? Oh, only like 8%. Maybe we should do it, you know, in like a year or so, like put it on the backlog for now. We'll think about doing it later, or we'll try to find a workaround to make it work now. But it is really about how many people can see those kinds of things, analytics, you know, past data in terms of usage, all those kinds of things, and then the technical capabilities. So I really, that's the, also the really interesting part of being in technology and user experience design, is just trying to see what are the cool new things that we could be doing, and then like how much can we actually do right now?
Doesn't it seem like though the web is starting at kind of the beginning of this hockey stick where, you know, Internet Explorer is going to die, everything is going to be evergreen. Suddenly Safari is holding the web back, but for people that are on evergreen browsers that are updating every 20 minutes, maybe it's less than a year before you can do that crazy thing. Maybe it'll be a couple of months. Like it seems like there's non-technical parent who never upgrades, and then there's everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting. Just the fact that you said Safari is like the one holding people back now, that always kind of blows my mind, because before they were kind of like the new thing. But yeah, I think I'm
it's
really
true, though,
excited.
If you found it to be true, though?
Yeah, totally. It's so sad. But that is, it's pretty much what's going to happen, I think, unless they really continue to, you know, up their browser game. I think that that's really an interesting point. Like it totally is the future. I'm so happy that automated updates are a thing now, just because it really enables people to experiment way faster. Like how long it took us to wait for, you know, IE6 and 7 and 8 to actually go away. That was years, decades in some cases, like 10 years plus. I'm just so happy that we're at this point now where, you know, Flexbox came in and I was able to start messing with it pretty immediately, because WebKit is supported by so many browsers and then the rest of them had already started implementing it. Yeah, I think that I hope that the web continues to enable us to do things faster and faster. And I'm so happy. I'm just so excited.
Have you had any situations where these automatic upgrades have been automatically breaking stuff? Where you just wake up one day and you're like, oh, wow, this whole section of our site's broken now. Thanks, Chrome or whatever.
Definitely happened with Chrome before. So there have been some cases where gladly a lot of browsers will have like a beta version where they'll implement these things for like the overnight updates. And then a lot of people don't have those versions. They've got the ones that update like maybe once a month or so. So we'll have advance warning and then we'll try to implement fixes beforehand. But yeah, there definitely have been cases where it's like, this is going to happen soon. It's happening now. Like they've implemented the monthly update and we're screwed and we need to fix this right now. But, you know, it's just a part of the ever changing world and keeping up with things.
Yeah. Yeah. I've just upgraded this laptop to Windows 10, and there's a whitelist internally for enterprises that says these websites will never change. They're old and they suck and we know it. So when you visit those websites with Edge says, sorry, this is, you know, the expense reporting system sucks. You have to use Internet Explorer. So Internet Explorer is like frozen in amber, like Jurassic Park, right? It'll never change.
Wow.
So it seems like we were talking before, that there's non-technical parent who is stuck, and then there's the evergreen people. Like the enterprise people are stuck, right? They're going to keep using crappy websites that they wrote 10 years ago, and everyone else is going to use a fresh new browser.
That's kind of interesting the way you put it. It kind of feels like a two-class system of the internet, which is a interesting dystopian feeling. It's interesting because I used to actually work at a part of the government, specifically doing web design for them. And that was a really interesting experience because even though this was in 2008, you know, getting Photoshop was really hard. And getting everything I needed, like Dreamweaver, which was okay to use at the time, and I had to use XP for Windows. It was really a different experience from what I was used to. I was used to using a Mac, and I was used to having everything pretty easily available to me. But it was a prime example of like what that experience is probably still like for a lot of people. Yeah, I mean, it's a very complicated thing to think about. And I wonder, like, how can we really make that transition better for people and faster for people?
My wife, on her laptop, she uses Chrome, and she's going to school at these colleges. And you would think that you spend all this money on a college, you would have really great, awesome software. It is like surfing the web in, like, 1997. She is installing old versions of Firefox because her professor is saying, like, if you want to use Blackboard or whatever stupid collaboration app that's not something basic like Skype, like GoToMeeting old ass version. See, I just swore on my old pet on my own podcast. That was bad.
For shame.
Yeah. If you're using like these old collaboration softwares that you have to use specific versions of. So I'm like, why do you have Chrome, IE, Firefox, and Edge all open? Oh, well, I've learned. And this is my wife is not technical. I've learned that these sites want these browsers. That's way more than anyone should ever have to suffer. That's like unacceptable.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I remember that was a really big thing that people would do. And I guess they were still trying to do when they don't want to rebuild their sites, is that they'll throw up a, this site is optimized for Firefox kind of thing. And it's like, why?
Optimized in air quotes, optimized.
How does that even happen?
Why don't they just say it? Like, they literally say optimized for this horrible old version of this browser. This site is old. We will never upgrade this site. We are sorry. We have no money. go browse with Safari.
Yeah. Maybe that would be a better way of putting it. And then maybe they can have like a sign up form and like a donation form, and then they'll have a new website in like 2 years. It'll be great.
Have you ever had to cut users off completely with just the, sorry, you're the 1% and not the good 1% that have lots of money. You're the 1% that have IE6. You're done. Goodbye. Come back later.
Yeah. We've had to do that at SoundCloud, actually. We had a version switch from what is called classic to the new version of the site. And some people were incredibly attached to the old version. So we kept it around for a bit and we had the ability to turn on the new version. But then we just had to say, it's just unfortunately not worth the amount of maintenance that we're putting in. We just really need to just switch everyone over. We're turning it off at this point. Sorry, all of you. Like, we love you, but like, we can't.
Well, who is all of you though? Is it like, sorry, both of you too?
Sorry, all 15 of you. Like, you're great. I mean, it was a fairly, like, a lot of people definitely were really attached to that version. Mm-hmm. And we tried our hardest to support it, but there is just a point at which you're spending more time supporting an older version of something than working on improving the site and working on new versions of it. And sometimes you just have to let it go after a bit.
Yeah. It's also difficult from a designer's perspective that do you let it be ugly? Like, it's totally functional. It just doesn't look right because web fonts or because SVGs. Like, my blog doesn't look right on old Android devices, but I don't block them. I mean, I should probably shame them. I should probably pop up a banner and just tell them that they're bad people, but
update.
I don't.
Update! I mean, I think, you just kind of let them go. It's a sad way to say it, but yeah, you know, I mean, if a person refuses for some reason to update to something new, you just can't support them forever. It's just unfortunately not really the way evolution works.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Well, you just invoked evolution.
Bam.
It's true though, right? I mean, do they deserve a nice looking web?
I mean, if they can, there's the other thing too, is about like affordability of things. I mean, in terms of school, a lot of the time they can't really afford to upgrade to these new things. And same with the city government. Like, I totally understood why they were so cost efficient and really asking, why do you need this thing? Why do you need this thing? And it's because they have to spend so much money and really, for a lot of people, technology just isn't very affordable in terms of keeping up with everyone else. And especially with our 2 year, actually now it's like a 1 year phone cycle or even a 6 month cycle for like new technology in some cases. It's very intense.
Oh, and that's a really good point. And I, you know, you could see where you and I were going, but I think we both pulled back for a second there when we realized that it should not be about economics, right? You should be able to have a free evergreen web. But this also brings up that point, like you have some old but totally functional software. Why should you have to update it to use something fancy? It works. It works. So it's a little bit unfortunate that some of the evergreen browsers don't have a compatibility mode to just say, hey, Chrome 58, can you just be Chrome 34 for just a minute?
Yeah, that would be beautiful. I mean, I know there's the concept of graceful degradation, and that's been, I love that that has been kind of a methodology that a lot of people have taken, like how some browsers don't support border radius, blah, 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 but they still look acceptable and they still function acceptably. I think it, like, ideally that would definitely be a mode where a website would just automatically transition when like it reads the head or something of a site and it says like, oh, this is good for Firefox this version, Safari this version, et cetera, et cetera. I think that would definitely help to solve a lot of problems in certain cases, especially since we've got so many testing sites where it's like, oh, this is how it looks across. Well, how do you fix these problems when you encounter them?
Yeah, if the site could carry along with it an explanation of these are the features that I need, and I know some of them are old, but please, you know, don't take these features away.
I need them.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for chatting with me today. This has been super fun.
Of course. Thank you so much.
So people can check you out at catsmall.com and learn about, and also I want to real quickly, you made a video game. You made a couple of video games. Can we play these online or can we buy them in an app store?
Yes. So you can play some of my free games on my website, catsmall.com, and Prism Shell has also been released on iOS, Android, Windows, and Mac. And you can go to prismshell.com to learn more about that.
Very cool. We'll put both Prism Shell and the links to the apps in the App Store and your website in the show notes.
Awesome.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.